Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Monday, September 13th, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools that I've ever been exposed to. These tools are available absolutely free on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it'll take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using for great benefit in my life for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn the experience of any negative emotion that I encounter or generate into part of the infallible guidance system that each of us has been given. And you can also download the actual tool itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click on it, download it, print it off, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows like this one where people have been stepped through the use of that worksheet process or given powerful testimonials about how the use of that process has improved the quality of their lives, or given or had discussions about some of the dynamics that allow such a simple tool to be so powerful and effective. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness and get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We're also doing the Course in Miracles workbook lessons, and so today is the 256th day of the year. This lesson reads, "The Creator is the only goal that I have today. The way to the Creator is through forgiveness here. There is no other way. If sin had not been cherished by the mind, what need would there be to find a way to where you are? Who would still be uncertain? Who could be unsure of who he is? And who would yet remain asleep in heavy clouds of doubt about the holiness of him whom the Creator created as sinless? Here we can but dream, but we can dream we have forgiven him in whom all sin remains impossible, and it is this we choose to dream today. The Creator is our goal. Forgiveness is the means by which our minds return to him at last. And so, Father, we would come to you in your appointed way. We have no goal except to hear your voice and find the way that your sacred word has pointed out to us." So lesson 256 in the Course in Miracles experiment by Pam Grout reads, "Scoop up the new day." She quotes Elizabeth Gilbert as saying, "Participate relentlessly in the manifestation of your own blessings." So Pam writes, "Hozo, H-O-Z-H-O, is said to be the most important word in the Navajo language. When you live, quote, in Hozo, close quotes, you are in alignment with your creator, with your brothers, with the betterment of the whole world. That, says lesson 256, is my only goal today. In Hozo, I'm not trying to triumph over my enemies. I recognize there are no enemies. And I'm actively seeking anything. I know I already have everything." So that accurately reads, "I'm not actively seeking anything because I know I already have everything." Franciscan priest Richard Rohr spent a summer taking a census of four communities in New Mexico's Acoma Pueblo. Because it was hot and sticky, he'd jump in his orange pickup and at sunrise watch as mothers stood outside the doors of their homes with their children. They would reach up with both hands to scoop up the new day, pouring its blessings over their heads and bodies. So today, as we seek to live in Hozo, read this Navajo prayer aloud. In beauty I walk. With beauty before me I walk. With beauty behind me I walk. With beauty above me, I walk. With beauty around me, I walk. It has become beauty again. It has become beauty again. So that's our Course in Miracles lesson. The Creator is the only goal I have today. And the Course in Miracles experiment commentary from Pam Grout. And we have, as is usual, about 50 minutes to talk, to have comments, questions, answers, testimonials. 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. What's on your mind? How would you like to spend this next hour? Our intention with this work is to be of service. This Mind Shifters Radio began years ago, over 10 and a half years ago, because Michael and Jeannie at that time were traveling 8 to 10 months of the year. And as they would travel, they would be in one town for about a week, and then they would leave. And there'd be some excitement at the tools that were presented and the lectures and workshops that Dr. Rice would present all week long, and then they'd leave, and there was no support. So they decided when they had the opportunity to, when they were invited to do the Blog Talk Radio show, that it would be a wonderful way to provide support for people who wanted to continue to use these tools. And these tools include, but are not limited to, the Reality Management Worksheet, and the Three Early Memories of Conflict, the Responsibility Communication Worksheet, the Mind Goal Management Worksheet, the Mind Shifter Targeted Journaling Tool, etc. So all of these things are tools that Michael and Jeannie Rice make available. And the idea with this radio show is to provide support, to be of service to people who want to learn how to use these tools and others to improve the quality of their life and relationships. So when you call and press 1, it makes it easier for us to live into our intention. What's the intention? The intention is to be of service. There are many ways that we might be able to be of service. And you can help us craft each show when you call 563-999-3581 and press 1. Occasionally somebody will send me something that they think might fit with the show or provoke some comment or commentary. Let's see here. Someone sent me a Richard Rohr meditation or his daily newsletter. And it relates to having God be good. And Richard writes, "Your image of God creates you. This is why it's important that we see God as loving and benevolent, and why good theology still matters. One mistaken image of God that keeps us from receiving grace is the idea that God is a cruel tyrant. People who've been raised in an atmosphere of threats and punishment and promises of reward are programmed to operate with this cheap image of a punitive God. It usually becomes their entire view of the universe. Unfortunately, it's much easier to organize people around fear and hatred than it is to organize them around love. Powerful people prefer this worldview because it validates their use of intimidation. That validation of intimidation is quite effective in the short run. Both Catholicism and Protestantism have used the threat of eternal hellfire to form Christians. I'm often struck by the irrational anger of many people who hear that someone does not believe in hell. You cannot believe," he has it in quotes, "in hell. Biblical belief," in quotes, "is simply to trust and have confidence in the goodness of God or reality. And that cannot imply some notion of anger, wrath, or hopelessness at the center of all that is. Otherwise, we live in a toxic and unsafe universe." I remember listening to Michael Rice and Dale Ellen Hoffman talk about the Aramaic roots of words and the Aramaic words that were actually spoken when people and were then translated into several different languages ending in English, and then in the King James Version of the Bible where it uses the word hell. But the essence of what was being said in the original term was just to be out of the flow, just to be on the outside, just to be in the area of thoughts that are off the mark. And one of the words that was used and translated to hell was Gehenna, which simply was the name for the garbage dump outside of town, where they would have fires burning and they could throw the garbage in there and burn them up. But the essence of the image that most people have of fire in hell and comes from Dante's Inferno, not the Bible. It comes from artistic drawings and fantasy, you know, writings that people have. But as Michael Rice would point out, they all come from a mind that has been programmed in fear and hostility. It doesn't come from the ancient teachings. It doesn't come from the Aramaic language. What you hear, Michael Rice says, I forget how many times, but he says numerous times, Yeshua says, "Fear not, fear not, fear not." And those ancient teachings say fear is a demon to be cast out of the mind. Fear creates a distortion in perception. Fear is not productive. It is a creation of a distortion of perception. It is a creation of the human mind that's lost in errant thought. So So the last paragraph in Richard's writing says, Jesus tells us to love our enemies, as in Matthew chapter 5, verse 44. But the punitive God sure doesn't tell us to love our enemies. Jesus tells us to forgive, quote, 70 times 7, close quotes, and that's in Matthew chapter 18, verse 22. But this other God, this artificially created angry God, doesn't tell us to forgive. Many of us were raised to believe that people burn in eternity. But we usually had to repress this bad theology into our unconscious because it's literally unthinkable. Imagine keeping it conscious in your mind all day, every day, that if you make a mistake, and sometimes a mistake you don't even know you're making, that it's going to result in you burning in hell for all eternity. Well, you can't. You just can't function if you're thinking that everything you do might set you up to be burned. Not just a little burn on the hand that heals, but burned all over your entire body for all eternity. Most humans are more loving and forgiving than such a God, but we can't be more loving than God. It's not possible. So the punitive God is not God. There's when I read this, I was thinking about a news story, I forget how many years ago it was, probably over 10 years ago. But anyway, there was a minister who had created one of these mega churches. He was so popular, it had thousands of people attending every Sunday, attending service there. And the number 5,000 sticks out in my head. It may or may not be true, but it was a big church that generated lots of money and he had a whole bunch of other ministers that he had hired because he created this church from nothing, and it grew and grew and grew because his charismatic personality and his biblical message. And then one day he was sitting at home at night with his granddaughter on his lap, and he was watching television, and one of these advertisements came on with starving children. And there were, you know, children laying emaciated with flies crawling in and out of their noses. And he remembers that he just cried out, you know, to the God that he thinks he knows, how could you let this happen? And he got this insight, powerful felt sense, realization, oh my God, you know, God answering him saying, I didn't do that. You humans are doing that. I'm not doing that to people. You humans are allowing that. There's plenty of food on the planet. Why isn't it getting distributed here? And in that kind of a God moment, he had the realization that any true creator of life must love its creation the way he loves his granddaughter sitting on his lap. And he realized there's no way, there's nothing she could ever do that would make him want to punish her, you know, burning in hell for all eternity. And he had the realization, oh my gosh, this is a false picture of the creator, of the source of creation, of God, if you will. So he's a spiritual person, he's a religious person, he prayed over it, he meditated over it, and eventually he got up the courage to tell his fellow ministers that he'd been given this download from the Creator that there is no hell that we're going to burn in. And guess what happened? They ran him out of his own church. The theology that had been created was one of a vengeful God. And so when somebody comes along and says, wait a minute, God is all loving and there is no vengeance, it was threatening to the bureaucracy, the structure, the financial support, because they have people coming and paying and tithing to this church, and people with lots of money, because they want to hear the message about how when you're good, you go to heaven, and when you're evil, you go to hell, and so all these other people that don't believe the way we do, they're going to hell. And that's what people wanted to hear. So it's to us to wake up and realize, if we are buying into one of those negative, vengeful, hateful realities, even if it's as we're driving along and somebody pulls what we would consider to be a bonehead move in their vehicle and we judge ourselves as better and them as wrong, in that moment, those vengeful thoughts, those punishment thoughts, they are there, accessible for us to use the forgiveness process. By forgiveness, we mean a tool to remove the energies from my own mind-body energy system that don't belong there. Right? And as Way of Mastery says, of course you're going to feel angry, but stop rationalizing that it's useful. Your anger hurts you and those around you. The only useful purpose for anger that I've discovered in my life is to wake me up to the fact that my thoughts are off the mark, that I'm focusing on a tiny bit of the data that's hitting my senses, and that even if I'm focusing on the most useful things to focus on in this moment, I'm interpreting them negatively and counterproductively. And chances are, If you step back and watch, you'll be able to observe that whenever you're angry or really sad or really scared, the view you have, the viewing window you have on life is smaller and smaller and smaller the more intense your negative emotion grows. So what we like to do in this work is a two-prong approach. We like to remind ourselves that we come from love, we're made of love, we actually are love, and everything else is false. And then we like to be aware that we've got a lot of everything else in us. We've got a lot of falseness. We've got a lot of bitterness and shame and hurt and anger. And we could step into using those as the alarm system to wake us up to the fact that our perceptual process, our thinking process, is off the mark, and therefore it's creating a distorted perception. And we can pick up some tools that help us identify the error of thought, the misperception, the interpretation of negativity that is formulating our perception, and remove it. Once we remove that, whatever it is that's a negative emotion that's distorting our perception, we get access to a more accurate perception of what's actually going on in the world. And then with a better perception, we make better decisions. We feel more calm, we focus on the things we have control over, and our lives start going better and better and better directions almost instantaneously. At least that's been my experience. It's just amazing how quickly my perception can change and my experience be transformed. And the example that I haven't talked about for a while here is in response to a worksheet. And this probably happened about 8 or 9 or 10 years ago. I'd been using the worksheets for 6 or 7 years, and I'd been running the support group on Tuesday nights for at least 7 years at the time. And I'd gotten pretty good at getting solid results, practicing canceling my goal, practicing putting what I want on hold, practicing asking to be shown and then trusting that whatever image comes up, no matter how distorted or distracted it seems to be from the present moment content, it's going to be of value to me. And what had happened was I had, earlier in that day, had my ex-wife, and she'd probably been my ex-wife for 7 or 8 years at the time, maybe 9 years at the time, and she showed up in my office in what appeared to me to be just, you know, full on, I don't have any respect for you, and I'm going to walk in your office without permission when you're not there and sit down and make myself comfortable so when you come around the corner and walk into your office, you're shocked to see me, and then I'm just going to, you know, it just went on from there. My perception was that she had no respect for me, no respect for my boundaries, and that she was just there basically poking a sharp stick into my ribs, metaphorically speaking. And I got through that situation, but I realized that I had so much upset that I was going to need to do a worksheet on it. And it was a Tuesday night, so a few hours later I was in group, and I told the group, I need to hijack the group, and I need to do my own worksheet tonight. And I figured out that my mind was telling me that my ex-wife was the trigger and that what she did was walk in and sit down in my office without permission like she owned the place and talk to me about all kinds of ridiculous, irrelevant stuff that had nothing to do with all the serious topics we should have talked about and never got to talk about through the divorce. And I was using all of this to formulate righteous indignation, anger, fuming anger. And when I specified the goal that I wanted her to respect me and my property and my personal boundaries and talk to me about the things that were important. And as soon as I wrote that goal out, even before I got a chance to cancel it, this is the first time that I had one of those powerful shifts right there as soon as I specified the goal, I got a flash of an image of the very first time I was alone with my father-in-law, my brand new father-in-law. And we were riding. We were going to be driving 45 minutes one way, pick up a couch and drive 45 minutes back. And I was all excited. I was a young psychologist. You know, first time alone with his father-in-law, I was going to get all the kinds of great background information on the family and the history. And so why would that image flash into my mind? How far removed from, you know, 25 years later, how far removed could I be? How completely crazy is it for that thought to flash in my mind? But remember, I said, I've been training myself to trust that whenever I cancel my goal, whatever pops into my head is going to have relevance that I can't see. I'm just going to trust that process and go with it. This time, the relevance, although no one just listening on the outside would know, was immediately obvious to me. Because during that ride with my father-in-law for the first time ever, alone together, the only thing he would talk about was food and drink. I kept asking about the family history and where he grew up and his siblings and his parents and his grandparents, and he would either give one word or one line answers and then redirect to some food topic. At first I thought, well, that's fine. He's just going to be planning out where we'll stop for lunch on the way back or whatever. But the truth of it is that first prolonged meeting with my father-in-law could have been used by me to understand this is who he is. He doesn't talk about emotions. He doesn't talk about family dynamics. He doesn't talk about unresolved issues. He just talks about food and drink. That's his mode of operating. In that moment, I had such a tremendous shift in my perception of what had happened 5 hours earlier in my office. It was as though someone wiped my brain clean and put a whole different perception in its place. And instantly, instead of thinking, here's this woman who has no respect for me, who's just sitting here saying things that are really feels like a sharp stick poking in my ribs, instead of that, I saw all of the same picture with a completely different interpretation. I instantly saw this probably nervous, maybe even scared mother of a son who wanted to help her son but didn't know how to deal with the computer technology, etc. And she was nervous and she was desperate to help her son, and she was offering the only olive branch she knows to offer. She started talking about food and drink, and not because she was trying to stick it to me, but because she was out of her element and she was scared. And when I saw that, when that perceptual shift happened, I instantly had tears come up, instantly got in touch with the pain and sadness that the anger was covering up. So the more I train myself to understand that the productive use of my negative emotions is an alarm system to tell me that my perception is off the mark, that no matter how right I think I am, Guy Finley says, your anger doesn't prove you're right. Your anger only proves that you don't know what rightness is. So the more angry I am, my culture tells me, you know, fight harder and, you know, dig in and grit your teeth and, you know, shout louder and beat people down and make sure that you win because you know you're right and they're wrong. And the more angry you are, the more right you think you are. And Guy Finley says, yeah, that's just silly. My anger doesn't prove I'm right. My anger only proves that I don't know what rightness is. So the more we can remove the intense negative emotional experiences, the more our perception clears, the more we see a broader, more accurate picture of options, and the better we're likely to choose responses in life that improve our results. That's what we're here to talk about. 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, it'll put a little question mark by your phone number, and I'll announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation. Area code 610. Susan, welcome.
Hi, Dr. Tim. You know, I have heard you tell that story before, but you told it in even more detail this time, and it was great to hear it. And it brought to mind something I read just the other day by Guy Finley. He was giving a talk over the weekend, and sometimes I can get my way in there despite crazy family stuff going on. And his main point was all negative reactions are useless. Well, of course, that needs, you know, that needs explaining and fleshing out, but, and certainly negative reactions can be useful if you do the patter sheet and look at them and realize they're trying to tell you something. But in themselves...
Well, but think about it. Think about that. What he's saying in that point is not that the original energy you feel of negativity is useless, but when you act from it, when you react, it is not going to help improve anything. That's, I believe if you had him here to describe that more, that's what he would be saying.
Yeah.
Right. So when I act from the negativity, it makes things worse, not better.
Yeah. Right. he had
awareness of
audience.
It can direct me. Awareness of the negative action or emotion can direct me to self-correction, but I have
right.
to turn the focus inside to do that.
Right. That's it. Well, I have this whole little page here. He wrote, he does a very cool thing. He'll run a class, and he also will write something that's a distillation of his thoughts. So if you miss the class or you want a little primer or a preview, you can read this. And he calls it the single greatest spiritual secret in the world. Talk about a big come on there. But it is. It is. So, well, I just wanted to bring him in because he was just talking about that. And
so do you want to share that reading?
Sure. No moment can be different than it is. Whether we like it or not means nothing. Our distaste for it cannot change even the smallest thing taking place before our eyes. But this doesn't mean that change isn't possible. Far from it. We can do much better than to just unconsciously suffer the ache of useless resistance. Love that. We can learn to see the truth of the following fact and invite it to set us free. And then he says, this is the following fact, all negative reactions are useless. He goes on to say, anything they tell us is true about unwanted moments. Let me start again because I don't think I put the right emphasis. Anything they tell us is true about unwanted, okay. And anything they tell us is true about unwanted moments, usually pre-painted in their favorite dark color, is equally useless. To even suspect that negative reactions are useless is the beginning of the end of being used by them. And the clearer becomes this awareness, the sooner are certain higher forces set in motion, leading the way to our liberation. Being used by our negative, oh boy, that's good.
Yeah,
the whole thing.
He tends to put a lot of extra words and longer sentences together rather than parsing them down into shorter sentences. But the essence of his insight is always the same. The negativity is self-created. And
mm-hmm.
when we listen to it and we assume it's created from outside forces, we're just blind walking down a dangerous path. It's all
and you know
the same stuff.
What's weird about all that is you were talking about, you read that Richard Rohr thing, and I love the little illustration of it about the man who realized hell couldn't possibly exist, and then he gets thrown out of his church. I don't know how much of the cultures of the world have this as their base teaching, but certainly the Judeo-Christian tradition is so riddled with this idea of merit system and punishment if you do wrong and eternal punishment if you do terribly wrong or maybe not so even terribly and eternal heaven if you're good enough. It's a terrible, crippling psychological trauma for a whole culture. I every day when he says all negative thoughts, when Guy Finley says all negative reactions are useless, I'll wake up in the middle of the night and I will be in some kind of turmoil. And I know there's a thought behind it, but what I'm experiencing is the feeling. Then I go backwards, like hand over hand in the dark on some rope, feeling my way back to what is the thought. And the thought is a pre-verbal thought of unsafety, scary world, scary out there, not too safe out there, not even safe in here. And I'm wondering, you know, of course, my family had things happening, but the culture invites all of us to have that. Don't you think?
Yes. It's a very unhealthy culture. It's based on, you know, Michael Rice would talk about the energies of the generations are passed down, into three and four generations. It's the good and the not so good, right? But if you consider that as I sit here, my father's father was 16 years old as the Indian Wars were ending on this continent.
Wow.
He was 16 years old, which by that time meant he was fully an adult, right?
Right.
And we were still having people say, you know, we'll give you a reward for the scalp of an Indian. We'll have, you know, Indians in internment camps. They didn't call them that, but in prisons. The March of Tears and the massacres. My grandfather, not my great-great-great-great, mm-hmm. not my great-grandfather, mm-hmm. my dad's dad lived in the middle of that.
Wow.
So here we are just, you know, a couple generations away, but we can't, and just think about from just the couple generations, right? I had another grandfather who was in two wars as a military officer. And I had uncles that were in wars as military officers. My father was in the Korean conflict. So just think about the energies from just one or two generations back that we have of drama and trauma and, you know, so-called civilization, where it's mm-hmm. civilized for us to, you know, kill people with the death penalty. And so there's a lot of stuff that's woven into our culture that's not very loving, that's not very productive. And every one of us has deep exposure to that. And so we're carrying it around in our energetic fields, in our, you know, chromosomes, genetics, and energetics. So it's a question of, all right, if it's here, what am I going to do about it? What will I do with it?
Mm.
And hopefully I'll pick up tools and start dismantling some of it, because if I don't, I get to live with it, and then I get to pass it down to more generations.
Right. Michael talks about if you think of all the people in your past, it's an exponential multiplication problem, and you have billions of souls who have fed into the making of you. So it's what you're saying about your dad and your dad's dad and your other grandfather and so forth. But there is DNA coming. It's like rivers, river deltas, and rivers becoming smaller rivers and more and more and more. It's when he talks about it that way, I think, oh my God, I'm out of here. It's hopeless. I'm going to numb myself. Guy Finley was funny. He said, unless you're using or eating, which is using, or asleep or something, you're going to be feeling this stuff. You're going to be numbing yourself. It's there. It's here. The world is a mess. He said that. Man. So anyway, it's like running against the tide or something, or trying to outrun the tide coming in. I probably shouldn't use that image, because the tools do help, but they help. They'll dismantle one thing, and then there's another thing. It's like that game Whack-A-Mole. Another one pops up somewhere else.
Yeah, it is our life, right? So I don't like my life. Okay. Now what? I can sit and moan about how I don't like my life, or I can take incremental steps to make it better, make myself better, mm-hmm. get a little bit more productive in my approach to it, more positive, et cetera, and do things that mm-hmm. might feed or fuel my energy better. Tapping, breathing, doing worksheets, doing still point breathing, doing making sure that my sleep routine gives me enough, you know, sleep hygiene so that I have a better chance of sleeping well throughout the night. And then watch for the next opportunity to make my next interaction more productive and more loving.
Yeah.
But I don't have a magic wand, right? It's the only life I'm given, and my choice is I reject it or I deal with it.
Mm-hmm. One of the cool things that we all know, because we do it all the time, is we know how to be, even if we're not there yet. So we can practice being kind or loving or thoughtful, even though the inner crabapple is screeching and yelling for attention. It's just a lovely little crack in the armor that we can approach it from, not only the doing and using of the tools, but also deciding that this is going to be our modus operandi, even when we don't feel like it, and hope we do it. Of course, triggered enough and tired enough and sleep hygiene not being tended to enough, and we don't do very well, but I just like that extra. It's like a kind of hope that we can fake it till we make it, basically. I do a lot of that.
Well, you know, some people boil it down to a phrase like, stay the course, or, you know, this too shall change, or the only thing that's certain in life is change. And if we take heart, right, if we take consolation in the fact that everybody's been at this for generations and everybody's trying to do their best, mm-hmm. then, you know, if you go out and look for statistics or information to prove how bad humanity is, you can find it. You can always find it. But if you take another lens and you look at, you know, the history of violence on the planet, and most people say that today, if you look at it, you find out there are fewer wars on the planet right now. There's less violence in an absolute sense, and there's more not-for-profits that are trying to feed the hungry and solve problems. And so, you know, take the lens that you think might be most productive and look for the evidence that supports you thriving.
Yeah. That's good. So, Dr. Tim, I had a question about that mental health seminar that's coming up in October. I've been online. Either I'm not fully able to navigate that website, or they haven't put the hours when the speakers are going to be speaking. Is this like a conference that starts in the morning on one day and goes all day and into the evening?
Yeah, and I sent an inquiry email to one of the directors of that process, and her response was, they're working on it. You know, to be announced. They will get some schedules going, but it's a virtual, so an internet-based participation. You can get on it through whatever the platform is. It's something similar to Zoom, but it's not Zoom. And you can listen to the lectures you want to listen to. There may be breakout groups for discussions and all kinds of other potential thing. And it's October 8th, 9th, and 10th. And you can get a ticket for a minimum donation of $25. And if you can't even afford that, you can contact me and I'll make sure you get access for free.
Well, that's wonderful. Is this? It sounds interactive then, or at least in part.
Well, they're hoping that some parts of it will be. They've been working with the developers, people who have done other seminars like this since the coronavirus restrictions have hit. And so how it's going to unfold, I don't know. But they're looking for ways to have these panel discussions where I'm supposed to be part of a panel discussion on trauma, and I'm one of the presenters, right? And I don't know the details yet. So
So
we will
has been asking. I have a friend.
Well, I'll make that available as it becomes available to me.
Great, thanks. Very good.
All right. Well, two things. One is we have to get ready to start the second hour, and the other one is area code 828.
Hi there. This is Magda.
Hello, Magda.
Hey.
We just have a couple minutes. What have you got for us today?
I didn't realize it was so late. Hi, Susan.
Well,
Hi.
We have about seven minutes,
Magda.
But I do have to start a Women Healing Women seminar for the second hour, and I need to start that right on time because it's a full hour long.
Excellent. All right. Well, I will make it quick, and maybe it'll be easy for all of us. So when you and Susan were talking about, or Susan, I guess, you brought up the fake it till you make it, which is what it sounded like you were talking about, and then you labeled it, and I went, oh, okay, that's what you're talking about. And my question is, I really would like to get this straight for myself, but it seems like when I don't want to be nice to someone, when I don't want to be kind or whatever it is that I'm resisting, I thought that it would be good to work on my resistance rather than try to fake it so that I can deal with what is preventing me from having that be my natural and normal state.
Well, I don't think it's an either or. I think both are true. Right. So at whatever level in my life I can treat someone the way I would like to be treated or treat them with kindness, that will always provide better results in the long run. And whenever I'm tempted to be resentful or angry or strike out, I can use tools to uncover what that's about because that's always rooted in me. It's not rooted in the other.
Right. Okay. Okay, well, that makes a lot of sense to me. It's kind of like, okay, I'll do this. This is step A, and then later I'll do step B. I'll look inside.
And one of the things that I say that not everybody agrees with, even people who do this work, but what I say is if I'm unable to hold that space of love and be loving and be gentle, and I will excuse myself from the situation.
Mm-hmm.
I'll walk away. I'll say, okay, and I'll leave. And sometimes people are, you know, yelling after me, what do you mean, okay, get back here, you, and I just walk away because I know I can't stay there and be loving and be genuine about it. And and there have been people, even in this work, who are, they're like a pit bull with a bone holding me accountable for having done something horrible because I walked away from discussions where I couldn't have stayed loving. And so my best advice in that is do both.
Mm-hmm.
Either walk away if you can't be loving or fake being loving, and then go do your worksheets, tapping, breathing, and journaling about what it is in you that's generating the negativity.
Exactly. Okay. Okay, I like that. That's good. We can do both. And walking away is so, true to one's being, so authentic that it helps my mind and heart feel better about the faking it part. Because that is not authentic, except for the desire to be that way. That is authentic, but actually faking it is, to me, not authentic. But that's okay.
All right. There are times when you need to be. All right.
Okay.
Well, I thank you both for this comment and questions, and I will mute you so we can make the transition here so there's enough time for the one-hour Women Healing Women intensive hour. Jeannie and Michael are driving today, and she said there have been many questions recently about the Women Healing Women intensive. And since Michael and Jeannie are driving today, she decided to play an actual hour from one of her intensives. And that's coming up right now. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love. Everything else is false. And we'll be back again tomorrow.
And I noticed it more on yours, and I don't know if I was just tuned in more than I did on the first two ladies that read. But you also have a what we would call a house divided against itself, because one place you'd say, I want them to leave me alone, and then you'd say, I want somebody to be with me.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and so it's like wanting...
I can feel that. I can feel that in here. I can feel that fight, that dichotomy, that...
Yeah. You ready to let that go so you can be whole?
I am.
Awesome. Anybody else? Before we move to the next one?
I just have a question on one.
Yeah.
So, this was troubling when I did the worksheet.
Uh-huh.
And now when I read it, it's still bothering me.
Okay.
And I...
It's bringing up bothering you.
Yes, bringing
that's up. That's one of the things we'll point out tomorrow when we do the worksheet, is you can't feel anything that's outside of you.
Okay.
So something can trigger it and bring it up for you, but it can't bother you.
Okay.
But it can bring up bother for you.
Bring the bother for me.
Yes.
Okay. And I will want to punish them, whoever, by no answer, unconscious or in denial.
Right. There were a couple people that did that. They had no punishment listed.
I couldn't put punishment.
Okay. And a lot of that has to do with upbringing. You know, you don't punish people. You don't, that's not nice. You don't act like that. You know, but if you'll be honest with yourself, even if it's withdrawing, leaving someone, whether you leave the room or leave geographically, withdrawing from someone is one of the worst punishments you can do. Think about prison. They put people in solitary confinement. Mm-hmm. They move them away from other people where they have no human contact. So a lot of times it's like, you know, why wouldn't, you know, and look at it two ways. One is, I would never do that. Well, I didn't ask you if you did it.
Mm-hmm.
What was your punishment thought? You know, we may say, oh, that's okay, oh, you stupid person. You know, I mean, it's like...
But I wouldn't even admit that.
So why would you admit it? That's what you
know.
Need to do. That's
yeah.
where you need to go, is to be able to feel safe enough to admit that you've got that in you.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's this. And until you can face it and own it, you can't get rid of it.
But I think the opposite was true of my upbringing, is that I was punished all the time.
Ah, so you were determined to not punish someone else because
right.
you were punished all the time. But if you're honest with yourself, take a deep breath and think about one of the situations you wrote about. Wouldn't you have loved to have either screamed or kicked or run away or something?
Denial. Like I'm not willing to admit that. Either.
Right. So that will probably be a big one for you when you can get to the point where you can admit that I've got some rage in there. And, you know, the original rage starts in all of us when we gave this up.
Mm-hmm.
When we were around the age of 3 or 4 and we said, this isn't enough. You know, just being out here picking up daisies instead of, you know, working out in the field or doing something else, you know, that's not good enough, so I need to do something else that they'll approve of me. And so we gave that up and started overlaying ourselves with this, and when we gave this up, that's the birth of the original rage. And so when you get back to that, that's going to be a biggie.
Yep,
when you can admit that you've got that in there, and probably underlying it is the pain of it.
Are we going to touch on this more later, or is this a good time?
We can. No, go for it. You've got a question.
Yeah. Well, mine's kind of like hers. I saw that. How would I punish or, you know, hurt them back? And I guess I've worked hard to forgive.
Okay.
I have removed myself geographically.
So leaving.
And not spoken to.
Okay, that's big punishment. Both of those, leaving and not speaking, both of those is cut them off. And when you cut them off, you cut off a piece. I mean, you know, we're all connected.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, you know, oh, I don't like that finger, so I'll just cut it off, cancel that off. You know, and so, I mean, who's hurting from that, you know?
Well, I went then into another corner, and I reached out and sent my brothers and sister a card, and it was, hi, just thinking of you, and left my phone number, and, you know, so I took the first step.
And what happened from that? Did they come back?
Yeah.
Good.
And we've been friends, and I've been able to hold on to that forgiveness. Now, you were talking about your possible, I don't like to say, I don't like to say things because it gives it energy to live.
But if it's in there, it's already got energy.
I'm curious.
You know, that's like me saying, you know, that she gave me that proclamation that I had, you know, breast cancer. Well, I'm going to think, yeah, no, I'm perfectly healthy, I'm happy. But deep inside, there's that anger that's creating that energy of potential breast cancer. I want to deal with that. I want to look at that anger and be honest. It's there and get rid of it so that I can live. And just denying it is like saying, oh, we can spray some air freshener on the trash can in there. We can live with it through the weekend.
Yeah, I'm curious to see if, you know, if I am in denial and say I have forgiven. And
we do forgiveness. That's pardoning. If you let them off the hook for whatever it was they did. Or if you let yourself off the hook because some behavior you did was maybe off target, that's pardoning and that's not forgiveness. And so we're going to do forgiveness tomorrow.
Yeah. To me, forgiveness is, well, you forgive that action from either person, but and you forgive, but you don't forget and you protect.
But if all you're doing is pardoning, you're not getting rid of the root of it.
Okay, because, so that's still pardoning
there.
Okay.
Yeah, forgiveness is going inside and looking at, and we'll go over that tomorrow. That's tomorrow's workshop.
Okay.
So, but,
that'll be good.
Yeah. And so how do I go inside? How do I remove those things? How do I get to the root of it and pull it up? You know, it's kind of like if you go out and you mow your yard and you cut the tops of the weeds off. But if you don't get down and pull the roots up, they're just going to come right back.
Yeah, gotcha.
You know? So this is about getting down and getting those roots out. So, and some of them are not our own. Some is genetic. You know, like the basis of my book that I'm writing is based on something I saw in a breath session that is a genetic thing. And it's come up, and now it's my turn to heal it. And I can either heal it so my children don't have to go through it, or, you know, I mean, somewhere along the way, somebody's got to step up and say, I'm big enough, I'm going to look at this. And so that's what we're going to do. What happens is those crystals dissolve and they release their content. Now that'll be emotions, thoughts, and the drug that you use to suppress it. They're all held in the crystals that they release. That's all that like arthritis and things like that are, is crystals in your joints. And so different people store those kind of things in different places in their body. So where you have aches and pains, that's a place to pay attention to. Somebody mentioned Louise Hay when we were outside. And she's right on target on a lot of things. I really like her when I start, you know, something starts hurting or whatever, I will look to, okay, what does she say? What's that? And, you know, it's things like, and we were talking about having the pain in the hip area, and most women have that. And part of that, it could be, like, I know part of mine is around sexual abuse. But it can also be about moving forward, because that's the part of the body that references moving forward. if your knees are hurting, it's that you're not getting your needs met. And, you know, so different things like that. Your hands, what can you not handle? If you've got eye issues, what do you not want to look at? You know, if your hearing is bad, what do you not want to hear? What do you not want to pay attention to? So your body is speaking to you, and we just need to tune in and listen to it, and that's why I think the yoga was really good this morning and tapping into that. So anyway, it stores in those crystals, and that's what happens a lot of times when people have been, like, say, you know, they were an alcoholic and they've been dry for 30 years. And then they start doing things and get more and more vital, and all of a sudden they fall off the wagon. Well, part of that is that they got more vital. You know, we listed the things, you know, have you been doing more of the right things? Had you hit a new level of vitality? You know, what's your elimination? And the last thing is craving that drug. Well, the crystals, when they melt and they release the alcohol that was used, then all that person can think of is alcohol. And so they go drink. If they realized that they were going through a healing process and what was happening, you know, they could probably, you know, handle it, deal with it a little better, and look at it a little differently than it just being in their face. The lady that wrote the super immunity, Carrie, she called Michael, it's just been a few months back, and she was like, Michael, I don't know what's going on with me. Because she's very clean in her eating and everything, you know, she does this work and all. And she's like, I am stuffing my face with ice cream. And she says, I don't eat ice cream. You know, Michael refers to it as cow puff. Because there's actually a certain amount of that that's allowed in your milk products. But the company I worked for before the pharmaceutical company, one of my customers was Domino Sugar. And I'll never forget when I went to visit their plant. And they were showing how, you know, the cane, you could see it going up the conveyor belt, you know, it's going into the grinder and all this. And they actually admitted that, you know, there's so many snakes that goes up with the cane. And there's so much meat that's allowed in your sugar before it's considered contaminated. So anything that's processed, you can expect that that kind of stuff is in there. But anyway, I don't know how I got off on that one. But you did. But she was saying, you know, all she could think of was eating ice cream. And she says, well, I don't do that. And so Michael was processing with her, you know, well, what are you going through? What are you dealing with? And what she came down to was that whenever her and her father had some kind of a conflict or a confrontation or a conversation. Thank you for answering that one for me. I don't know if I went back and changed yours to confrontation, but when her and her father would have a confrontation and, you know, a big argument would happen, then to make up for the big blast and to make things smooth in the house, he took them all out for ice cream. And so she was having some confrontation going on, so those crystals were dissolving, it was in her face, and ice cream was the drug of choice to make things right, and that was what she was slipping into. That's also referred to as TSRs, which is Terminate and Stay Resonant. On your computer, does everybody have a computer? You know what I'm talking about, that down at the bottom of the computer screen, there's little icons that are always there, and you just have to do one click, and it opens up on your screen. Those are Terminate and Stay Resonant. They're really on, but they're kind of like shrunk down or something and kind of out of sight. And it only takes one click and they're up. You follow me? Is everybody with me on that?
Mm-hmm.
We all have...
I don't know anything about a computer.
Okay. If you open the computer up, all along the bottom of it, there would be... And you can choose what you want to leave down there. Like I've got Word documents and Excel spreadsheets and their database and, you know, certain things that I open a lot. Instead of going over and having to click start, programs, you know, and find it or whatever. And I've got so many on my desktop, it's cluttered. So what I do is I put the ones I use most often down here at the bottom. And all you have to do is one click and it opens up. So it's like an immediate, almost like flipping the light switch and the lights come on. Instead of having to get a ladder and put a light bulb in and, you know, do all these other things, you just flip the switch. We have Terminate and Stay Resonant things within us that we have built that this is my go-to. My go-to used to be leaving. And it was the first thing that popped in my mind when I felt like my back was against the wall and I needed to escape. And, you know, it's like I can't handle this stress. I didn't like conflict. So it was like I'd leave, whether it was geographically leave or just mentally leave or whatever. And so when you build those into your system, it's automatic and it only takes a quick trigger. Just like on the computer, you just do one click and it's open. So if that's your built-in run-to, then when something happens and it gets triggered, it's in your face. It's not something you think about and say, okay, I think I'm going to leave. It's just that's automatically in your face, I got to leave. I got to get out of here. What I've discovered is because one of the things, and Michael knew that was my trigger. I mean, that's what I wanted to do. And so he was like, you've got to take leaving off the table. That's just not a choice anymore. And what I went to and what I've realized is just below that is, okay, if I can't leave, I'm just going to get totally pissed. I'm just going to, turn into the Tasmanian devil or whatever. It's just another cover-up. And so now I have to deal with that. Okay, what am I going to do with that? I need to handle that. I need to look at what's below that. Anger is also just a drug to cover the pain. So when I went a little deeper in that, I realized, it's like, okay, let's say that we're having a confrontation or a discussion, and I feel like I'm losing. And so leaving's off the table, so I can't run away. So it's like my fear comes up, that because of past relationships and being abused and everything, it's like, okay, now it's going to hurt. That's going to be the next thing that comes along. And so it's kind of like, possums roll over and play dead, and they're, they're not vicious or anything like that. But you back one in the corner, and it's going to come out fighting. And so it's kind of like that. It's like, okay, I need to survive. But if we think about it, we'll talk about power persons more later, but you had a person in your life who had more power over you than you did, and you felt like your survival depended on them. It's usually a parent, but sometimes it could be a grandparent. You can also change power persons throughout your life. People that join the service, their officer or whatever becomes their power person. They do, jump, how high do you want me to jump, and it's based on survival. And so what we'll do is we will end up, when there's no stress, let's say, my life was going along good as a teenager and mom was my power person, and so I was just a good little girl. I did what was expected of me, didn't cuss, and of course we weren't allowed to do things like go to movies and dances and stuff. It was just, I was raised super strict. But it was just be a good little girl, do what's expected of you and keep things smooth and calm. Then when stress built, then I would do what I needed to do to resist and survive with my mom, my power person. And that was, either to just remove myself, go to my room, avoid her, or whatever. So I'm no longer the good little girl, I'm in an avoidance stage. Then when I became ultra stressed, because yelling and screaming wasn't allowed, you couldn't do that, that was not being nice, then I would actually leave. I would just not be present at all. Even if I was still in the same room, it was just like I disassociated from the whole thing. And what I realized after doing this work for a little bit of time was that you can have more than one power person. And my mom, while she was the one that would give you the voice or the breath, or whatever, you knew she was pissed without her saying anything. What I realized was that my dad was my ultimate power person. He went to the farm all the time, and he still does. And so we had two homes. We had one in the city and we had the farm. And he had good excuses to go to the farm. The cows had to be taken care of or the, different things. And so he needed to go there. Mom didn't like the farm life, so she stayed at home. But what I got to realize, and that was his escape. Now, they've been married over 60 years. But most of the time, they're in two different homes. He's at the farm and she's in Bristol. And it's like I realized then that his way of surviving her temper and things like that, was he would leave. And he would do it nicely. Now, my dad, and you can ask anybody that knows my dad, he is the calmest, gentlest soul that you would ever meet. I've never seen him lose his temper or anything like that. I'm just super calm. So I realized that what he did was he stayed nice, but he left. And so what I wanted to do was leave. And so he was my ultimate power person, and that went into some different venues. It's kind of like we call them hydro effects. When you're doing a worksheet and you may be doing it on, your next door neighbor, and all of a sudden, oh, I need to do that same thing on my brother, and oh, I need to do that on my last boss, and that same issue happened with dad, and it's just like the hydra was a mythical creature in Greek mythology. You cut off one head and 10 other heads came out. It was like you couldn't win. It just kept, And so that's what happens when you start doing your worksheets, and that's why we also say to write them down, because, you know, those things you would lose if you were trying to do it in your head. So if you write it down, then you've got a memory of it to go back and do that. But there's two tools. One, you've got the commitment. That is something I want you to read. It's also at the bottom of the sheet that we did yesterday, what your healing's going to look like. It's incorporated part of it into that, that when you kick into that, what my healing's going to look like, and life's horrible and terrible and everybody's awful and mean and, you know, I feel like crap and all this kind of stuff, then you're going to make a new commitment. I'm going to do things different. I'm going to change this right now. Instead of, like you were talking this morning, your cells even remember. So it's not just, you know, in your brain, but your cells have memory, and we have to change those because we're just functioning out of the past when we just do that reaction. It's reaction, doing an action again. And so the commitment is one thing that, you know, you're making a commitment that you're going to do things differently in your life, and you're going to make a new stand. So that's one tool. So when we partner up, first I want you to read the commitment to each other, and then we're going to do what we call a love exchange. And the way you do that, and I like, there's two different ways. I like where you actually touch. I think it's really sweet. But we had an 11-year-old at Heartland, and she's the one that actually talked us into doing this. And used to, we just did the love exchange facing your partner. And then she says, no, you know, we got to connect. And she was actually Ari's partner. And so she would put one hand on the other person's heart, and then they would put their hand, and then you would put your free hand on top of their hand. Mm-hmm. So it's just a total heart-to-heart connection. And then what you're going to do is one person, and so one person in each partnership, say, I'll be light.
I'll be light.
Okay. So the person that goes first, okay, everybody's going to get to send and receive. Okay, and I'll tell you in a minute which one goes first on sending. So when you're the sender, just close your eyes and go inside and find the deepest, clearest love that you can find. Whatever it takes to get you to that space. Whether it's thinking of that newborn, whether it's thinking of a kitten, whether it's thinking of being out with your feet in the sand, whatever it is that can get you back to that connected, loving space. And once you get there, you open your eyes and send that love. Just imagine that you're just pulling that love up and you're sending it through your eyes to your partner. Now the partner, the one that's receiving, is going to sit with their eyes open so that they see when their partner opens their eyes, they'll know that they're sending. And see if you feel anything at all. Now, most of the time we're saying, you know, run your hand between, you know, or whatever to see if you feel anything. And you can do that if you want to. Or just sit and just feel it and see what you receive. And then reverse roles and do it the other way. Any questions on either side of that? Okay. Light, you're going to send first. Okay? And so just face your partner and do the... One that's worded a little bit differently on every mirror, and it's one you read to yourself in the mirror.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if I shared this in the class yesterday or if it was here, but there was a lady that I worked with over the phone. I do private sessions. And so I told her, I said, go to the bathroom and stand in front of the mirror, and I said, reach your hand out and put it in on your reflection of the heart. And then put your other hand on your physical heart here. So you're touching your reflection and yourself, and then read the commitment to yourself. And so she felt such a shift on that. It was just, it was really powerful. So that's on every mirror in the house. So read it to yourself while you're brushing your teeth or whatever you're doing.
How is that different? And what we did, what I did is Susan gave us both of them together laminated.
Hmm.
So you could just switch it over, but you could do it either way.
Yeah.
And I have that on my bathroom mirror behind my faucet, leaning up against the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
So whoever's in the bathroom sees it.
That's awesome.
And, you know, you don't...
It's laminated, so it's protected.
It's protected from the water, and, you know, so everybody sees it and gets that energy from
right.
it, whether they actually read it or not.
Right.
But I read it because the mirror's right there, so
mm-hmm.
you can just read it to yourself.
Right.
Awesome. Tell her what you told me yesterday.
I had it down as
this way.
My commitment
to you.
And I had that one facing up. And I got mad at my husband, so I turned it around to my commitment to me.
Okay, a little bit of...
I did some worksheets
that one.
When the words differ.
It's where this is, I promise to trust you enough to tell you the truth, and I promise to trust myself enough.
Okay. So
and, yeah, because what you'll find is in a lot of things, you know, like especially, we're going to do the worksheet here in a few minutes, the forgiveness worksheet. And one of the things is, you know, when you get down to the bottom, if you're familiar with the worksheet, it says, when have I ever done this? And so a lot of times, you know, you've got a goal for someone, I want them to, you know, treat me lovingly. Well, how many times in your life do you not treat you lovingly? Mm-hmm. You know, or I want them to trust me. Well, how many times do you not trust yourself or your own thoughts or your own opinions? You know, so you got to bring it back that what we're accusing another person of not giving us, we're not giving ourselves either. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so first of all, take your spring that you got. Take it between your fingers and push it down. What's going to happen if you let it go?
Morning.
They're going to fly. Yeah, and then we're going to be looking for them everywhere. So that's what happens when we have issues in our life and we don't want to deal with them. We don't want to look at them. We want to pretend like it doesn't happen or I don't feel it. You know, if I just stay positive all the time or whatever. These things are pushed down a lot of times as a young child when we're open and vulnerable and we just buy into whatever usually our power person has fed to us. That's true about us, and we get unconsciously hang on to it. It goes down with energy, you know. Like you said, you've gone through a lot of your life. She didn't answer any punishment thoughts on hers, and it was. I told her, I said, you know, you're unconscious in that area because everybody has something there. But she said, you know, well, that wasn't nice, or you weren't supposed to punish, or whatever. But even though, you know, you might outwardly, you know, say, well, I'm not going to punish them. That's okay, what you did, you know, I let you off the hook for that. And then you walk away with, oh, it was so mean, they did hurt my feelings, you know, or whatever. And so it's pushed down with emotion. And so it's just like that. It has potential energy, and that has actually got the most energy. So you can walk around with your mouth saying, I want to be healthy, wealthy, wise, and wonderful, and beautiful, and have everything, and everybody be at peace, and all this. And inside you're like, oh, I'm worthless, I'm klutz, you know, whatever you call yourself. You know, I'm not worthy of that, or nobody loves me, or, you know, and those things have the most emotion to it. So it really doesn't matter what you're saying with your mouth. The things you're holding down and pushing down like that spring is sending out this wave that says, come show this to me. You know, it is actually becoming your issues and your disease, and that's what's going to draw in more than anything else that you say. And so what we want to do is to release it easily through worksheets instead of having it spring up in our face and grab us by, you know, by the face. You can keep them or you can put them back in, either way. So on the terminate and stay resonant, like I said, when things, for me, seemed unbearable, stress was up, my back was against the wall or whatever, that mine was, I want to leave. And one night we were sitting at dinner, and this was actually before I started writing the book and digging into what was really lying underneath, you know, my life was pretty cool, you know, I can teach workshops and tell you all how to handle your stuff. You know, I got mine handled. Right. But we were sitting at dinner, and Michael was like, oh, penny for your thoughts. You know, have you ever had anybody do that, ask you that? And I looked at him, and I'm like, there was no thoughts. It was just like, I had left. It was total blank. There really wasn't any thoughts, you know, and I was just like gone. And so we got to looking at that, and at that time I was working it with a book called Courage to Heal. And it's written by two women, Helen Bass and
Laura Davis.
Yes. Thank you. And it's an awesome workbook. If you've got any kind of physical, mental abuse that you've gone through to work through that workbook, it really brings out some good points. There's some things I don't agree with her on, but overall, it really took me to another level working with that. But anyway, so I was working with that, and then we got to talking and processing about it. And what we found, I'm going to go ahead and hand this out, because it's easier for you to see it than for me to try to visualize it for you.
Are you going to talk more about terminate?
Yes. Yes. And before I get away from that, you had asked me to share on the commitment thing. There was a man during one of the Healing Through Relationships, which is the tool that we use in that. And he had come up at the end of when we took intermission. He said, you know, my wife and I are getting ready to divorce. And I said, well, you know, take the commitment, read it to her. And he's like, you know, it's too late. There's too much water in this bridge. And I said, well, then you don't have anything to lose. I said, take it and read it to her. And he called me about 3 weeks later, and he said, we are like on our second honeymoon. He said, no more talking of divorce. He said, we'll get along great. He said, this is just awesome. And I said, that's fabulous. I said, when you read the commitment to her, does she read it to you? And he kind of staggered around, and he's like, she doesn't know I'm doing this. So he was like going in the back room and reading it to maybe her picture or something.
Oh.
And it totally shifted. We're all energy.
Oh.
And so, I mean, when we were doing that love exchange, did you feel the energy in the room?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Nancy and I were both like, whew. I mean, it was like the whole room was moving. It wasn't just us. And another lady had been at one of the workshops, and she heard that story being told. And she taught this in the Spanish community, and she was working with a lady one-on-one whose son, when he lived at home, and then when he got married, he left, and she hadn't seen him for 10 years or heard from him. I mean, it was like he just vanished out of her life. And she, so Nanae shared this, the story I just shared with you, with this lady. And so she went home and started reading the commitment to her son's picture.
Mm-hmm.
And in 3 days, he knocked on her door.
Wow.
I mean, it's when a person, you know, we send out this signal,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm holding this energy of fear. You need to come show me what I'm afraid of so that I can deal with it. And that person comes, and maybe they're a really angry, hostile person. And they show us their fear, but we're like, I didn't feel this till you came around. So I'm going to get rid of you, and I'm going to put this right back down where I don't have to look at it, which guarantees I get thrown in another person to do it, another person to do it, until I'm finally willing to say, oh, this is mine, I'm going to get rid of it, and then it totally changes what happens, what comes your way. It's like, how many of you ever played tug of war?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if we're playing and we're tugging, you know, back and forth, and I drop my end of the rope, it changes your game whether you want it to or not. So when we clear up the energy in us that's saying, hey, come be mean to me, then that person still needs to deal with their anger. So they're going to, you know, and every time they find somebody that's afraid of them, it's their opportunity to say, hey, why am I being so angry or hostile or whatever, except they usually don't look at it that way. But it's their opportunity. So if you're not bouncing back and giving them their feedback, then they will go do it with someone else because they need that feedback too. So it's going to change what comes into your world. It's going to change what you're drawn to. If you don't like the creation, you don't like what you're bringing into your space, then look at it and do something different because you're the one that's creating what comes. That doesn't mean you're at fault or blame for somebody coming in and being mean to you. But you do have a responsibility in there that drew them into your space. And cleaning that up, and that may still mean holding them accountable for their behavior that was off target. It doesn't mean you're letting the other person off the hook because, you know, well, I'm a fearful person. I need to deal with my fear, you know, and just let the angry person off the hook. No, they maybe need to be held accountable, especially if they were abusive. It might even require calling the cops or something. So it's not saying to let them off, but if you try to deal with that while you're in the state of fear or hostility, then you'll make a mistake. Remember we said this list came from doing something you regret. So when that is active, we don't have our full senses. It's like having blinders on and we can't see it. So anyway, on the terminate and stay resonant, what we realized was that one of my things was to actually totally withdraw. I mean, to just, it's like my spirit or my soul left my body and was hanging out in the room observing or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a way of being able to handle the situation without actually feeling or the full impact of whatever's going on. So what Michael and I started doing was when that would come up, instead of him saying, a penny for your thoughts, would be to help me look, you know, okay, you just checked out, what just happened? It wasn't at that moment we were trying to dig down in and find the, you know, the root of it or whatever, but to recognize the triggers. You know, did the lights just dim? Or did a certain build of a person just walk by? Or did the music shift? Or something happened to trigger it? And to start looking at that so I could be aware of the triggers. Because, you know, just like realizing that my TSR is to leave, to be aware when that comes up, oh, something just triggered my leaving. They show up. So when they show up, if we don't do the forgiveness work at that time, we don't let go of the fear at that time, what we will do is hook our fear into our image of the other person. And there's five folders, okay? Like, if you've been to the workshops, you've heard Michael say, don't think about a purple alligator. Now, you've got files on colors, so you know what purple is. You've got files on animals, so you know what an alligator is. But you probably never tied purple and alligator together. But now, you come to class tomorrow and I say, don't think about purple. What are you going to say? Because they're linked. They're actually chemically linked in your brain. It's kind of like if you think of your filing cabinet. You know, I have manila file folders about the car. And so all of the car stuff, whether it's insurance, you know, new tires, the mechanical work that's been done on it, whatever, all about the car, so they're all in one file. And then things about the condo, you know, there again, insurance or, you know, whatever. And so we link them together. So when they're linked together, just like I said, don't think about a purple and then alligator pops. Same thing on this chart. Anything in this chart that gets triggered, because you can see the lines, they're all linked. Everything's linked together one way or the other. So if, say, at the time of the rape that a certain song was playing, or the lights went out, or the person popped out of the door and I wasn't expecting them to be there and they startled me, then that gets linked to the event. It gets linked to my thoughts around it, the guilt, the blame, the denial, the physical abuse, everything else. It's all linked together. So now I'm going through life and I don't hear, say, Michael coming in the door and all of a sudden he's there and I'm startled. Okay, all of these files at some level will pop because they're all linked together. Even though that was a totally innocent event, I just didn't hear him come in, but it was that startle effect, and that was the same thing that happened when the abuse effect happened, then all of these file folders now pop out. And at some level, even if I just take a deep breath and go, oh, I didn't hear you come in. If I don't work on it right then, I've just added a little more energy to that event, pushed that spring down just a little bit more. And so being able to say, oh, okay, this has happened before, I need to breathe, that's absolutely the first thing, because holding the breath, and if you notice, if you're startled, one of the first things you do is, you hold your breath. A child that's having a temper fit, they lay down, hold their breath, you know, kick their feet or whatever. So breathing is the way you let it go physically instead of locking it into your tissue. So at some level, all of these will fire when one little piece is triggered. So that was what in the event at the restaurant when we were looking at, okay, what just happened that just triggered me to disassociate, to leave. There was, it may have just been a little something. You know, it could have been in a conversation that was totally innocent and all of a sudden just a little bit of blame for something popped up in my mind. Or a little bit of guilt or a thought of, oh, I forgot to do something. Now I'm, you know, I'm going to be in trouble because I didn't do it, or, you know, I forgot to pay a bill, or, you know, just any little thing. You may think it's not linked at all, but then if there is some kind of blame or guilt or fear attached to it, if there is a strong enough attachment to these other things, they're all going to fire. And so it's being able to get down to the bottom of that so that we can heal physically, mentally, and emotionally. So now what happens on this is then the fear comes up and we build our image in our mind of this person and that they bring up my fear. So it's their fault. So we're blaming them. So we've called them in and they've answered the call. They've resonated the fear. And we, if we don't, now at that point is the good point where you can go, oh, okay, this is mine. I let go of my fear. If we do that, then we clear this out and we don't link it to them. But if instead of doing the forgiveness work on it, we say, oh, they're the ones that made me feel fear. And we put it outside, we're externalizing over here. It's not my fault that I'm feeling this fear. It's their fault because of their behavior. We don't take the responsibility. We call them in because we're holding the fear to start with. Is everybody with me? Mm-hmm. Okay. So we blame them. Well, if they're not a conscious being, or blaming them for them just doing what we call them in to do anyway, is going to trigger their anger. So this is going to we're blaming them, and that's going to resonate their anger, and they're going to come back up and build a picture of us in their mind that we make them angry. And so then they're going to blame us for making them angry. And you see how this, it's just a vicious cycle. And it just keeps going and going and going. And there have been times that, and I said, you know, Michael may or may not agree with me on this one, and that's okay. But there have been times where I have to take an intermission. Not that I'm running away from it or denying that it's there, but to stop that cycle. Because if it's just continual, you know, it's like what happens physically, and it's all linked. The physical, mental, emotional is all tied together. But, and the body is so amazing. And you know that being a nurse. When you go in, and these are all some good things. I mean, the like, for instance, the autonomic, am I saying that right? Nervous system. It's what controls, you know, your heartbeat, your digestion happens, you breathe. Most of the time you're not sitting there thinking, okay, I'm digesting my food. You know, you're not doing that. It's just automatic. It just happens. You're just created that way, and it's phenomenal. But that's also where your body memory comes in, too, because it's just an automatic thing, and cells are remembering things. You know, if you have surgery, they put you to sleep so you don't feel the pain, but whatever part of your body got cut, it remembers it, and that assault is still there. So even though it's not in your conscious memory, your body has memory too. And so it needs to be cleared out as well. So when there is a sympathetic nervous system, tell me if I mispronounce any of this stuff.
You're right.
And that is the physiological changes that need to take place for you to survive. Some of those things come in really handy. If a lion's chasing you, you want to run. I mean, you know, there's just some things. But what happens is, and it's so cool, is that I'm not going to name all the organs that are involved in it. It's like the hypothalamus and the pituitary and all these things. And they create hormones in your body that will kick you into certain behaviors. And it happens within 1/20th of a second, which is the space between two heartbeats. So that's super fast that this kicks in. So it's not like you can think about it and decide not to do it. It's just your body's automatic response that is going to do this. And so if you are the type of person that, and I'm not positive, I guess I should look into this a little more, what creates one person being one over the other. But if you are in the fight, then what's going to happen is there's going to be epinephrine and cortisol, which increases your blood pressure, your blood sugar. It suppresses the immune system. It produces glucose. It turns fatty acids into energy to prepare the muscles so you can run. Now, that happens in a 20th of a second, that your body says, I'm giving you this glucose and all this stuff so your muscles are strong so you can just fight or you can run or you can, you know, whatever. And your body just does it. Another thing that's weird is that, well, it's not weird, it's awesome. It stops functions like digestion, salivation, and tearing because you don't need those if you're fighting or you're running. So it stops those. And it produces another chemical that makes your blood clot faster. So if you're a fighter, you're going to probably bleed. And so it's already prepared that your blood's going to clot quicker. I mean, like, it's amazing if you think about how the body does that. And we don't think about it. It just does it. And it makes you, you know, hyper alert and all that stuff. Now, there is another part, and you mentioned it actually this morning, the parasympathetic. Mm-hmm. And that is the part that says, okay, crisis is over, and puts everything back to normal. One of the two of you can be conscious enough to say, whew, you're stuffed up. Let me just send you love here, do the commitment, just hold the space for you while you process, you know, what's going on, how can I support you? But usually when you've drawn somebody in, you've got the matching bags of garbage and you're going to just trigger. And you're just going to do this thing. So sometimes you need to put it on the shelf and say, you know, I need to go get centered. We'll keep this conversation going later. You know, we'll bring it back when we're more connected space. Because if you just keep the cycle, you're going to totally destroy the relationship. And when I'm talking about relationships, it's with a partner, with a child, with a parent, with an employer, with a student, you know, whatever, co-worker, people at church. I mean, you've got relationships with the person in the mirror. You know, and so if at some time you don't sit down and say, okay, I need to deal with this so that I quit creating this.
then what happens is you become so hypersensitive that your 1/20th of a second happens every 1/20th of a second, and it's just continual, and your parasympathetic doesn't happen. You never get to that calming space. That's where you get burnout. That's where people have nervous breakdowns. That's where they just go into total overload. I mean, it's just, you know, continual so much, and your body never has that calming time. So physically, even though all of this is starts out with the reality that you've created about an event that happened,
mm-hmm.
then it's like you're just totally destroying your body physically.
And that's what causes like autoimmune things.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. the people that are constantly firing that,
yes.
fibromyalgia, lupus.
Exactly.
And diabetes, hypertension, it causes everything.
Yes.
Because if you're always like this, I mean, I'm right there. I've been like this for a year and a half. And
you can't keep going that way.
I can't keep doing it.
No.
I can't keep doing it. And you know, there have been times in my life where I had to quit. I took 3 years off from working full time.
Sabbaticals, they call them.
And I couldn't do it anymore.
There's even, you know, like pastors and clergy and things like that, they'll take time off to go away for a year just to, you know, it's like they can't handle the
mm-hmm.
everything that's coming out.
But
and we all have to do that.
Service profession.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Service
well,
profession.
Service profession. Yeah, exactly. Now the third one, the fight and the flight, you hear a lot of. And what you don't hear a lot of is the freeze. And that's like, you know, I was talking earlier, like the possum. What it does is it freezes. And that is when you're at a point where, you know, as long as you're in the fight or the flight, it's like I can either fight and win, or I can flee, you know, and I can make it and get to safety. But if you're at the point where it's hopeless, and I can't get out of here, you go into the freeze. And so that, when that happens, the way the body responds to that, it sends out, it's the same neurotransmitters, but it sends out endorphins and hormones and painkillers so that, you know, okay, I'm just going to freeze. I'm just going to lay here. I'm going to take it. So your body sends out these painkillers and things into your body so that you can survive the assault. You know, and I'm using it MS like, because I am talking about the physical abuse, but it can even be just a mental assault that the same thing happens, and you just freeze, and it's just like, okay, take it. You know, it allows it, like a possum, you know, they simulate death. I mean, it's just, you know, and that's when you disassociate, when you leave the body or whatever. Most people, when they do that, they come out of it, sometimes coming out shaking, but they come out without the memory. It's like blocking it off, being unconscious
mm-hmm.
about whatever it was that happened, and it's a way of, if I don't remember it, you know, if I don't have to look at it and I don't remember it, then it didn't happen to me, and I can go on with life. I went almost 40 years without looking at my physical assault that happened for 3 years of my life,
mm-hmm.
and it was like, you know, I've not seen him again,
mm-hmm.
and I've not talked to him again, you know, and it's like, you know, why even put energy
into
it?
Didn't happen, right?
Yeah, it didn't happen.
Before
it's a part of my life that's gone. I'm in a new era of my life. You know, why even look there? But there was such trauma there when it did happen. And when I finally started dealing with it, my body started releasing what it was holding on to and went into tremendous hip pain. I mean, my whole pelvic area, the bones just felt like somebody needs to go in there and just give it a good twist or something. You know, it just hurts so bad. And, I mean, it got so bad at one point that I went and had x-rays done because I just knew there was something, you know, bone cancer or something, cancel all that thought. But it was like, there's got to be something physically really wrong. And there was nothing. Absolutely nothing. So all it is that cellular memory of the event, hanging on to it. And when I was finally able to deal with it, even though it had been 40 years, then all of the cellular memory started releasing as well. And the pain and all of those things came back with it. So it's being willing to go through that, willing to look at it, because even though I was ignoring it and pretending like it didn't happen, it was there. And so, you know, we've got to deal with it because it's in there. But that's where people get the PTSD, too, because you come out of it, you don't have a memory of it, you've blocked it out. And that's what happens in the, you know, they go to war or, you know, whether it's a bad car accident and people block out what happened in the car accident, or whether it was rape or whatever it was. You block it out. You don't have a memory of it because you've actually kind of left your body on it. And then when you're asleep, especially,
your, you know, we have three minds. I feel like I'm bouncing here. If y'all need me to stop and do something different, tell me.
The point that she made, right?
Yeah.
To be aware of what's the lighting, what's the... Because,
yeah.
You know, as much as I know that, I tend to not remember it when I'm in that.
Right.
I tend to be focused on, oh, what's happening, not,
right.
Okay, wait a minute. What just happened around me? What did I hear? What did I smell? What did I think? And yada, yada,
yeah.
Yada, yada.
All your sensories.
Yeah.
Because
it happens so fast.
Because if you can be aware of that trigger, then you can also be prepared for it. Like, you know, say it's the light's going down.
Right.
You know, or whatever. I am one that, and, you know, I use the excuse that I leave it on in case somebody gets up at night, you know, doesn't stump their toe or whatever. But leaving lights on every so often, or night lights or whatever. I'm one that would go in a room, and if I know the light switch is just inside the door, I would reach in like this and flip the light on before I step
into
it.
Step in. Okay.
I kept a can of Raid's out the front door for years when I lived by myself.
So it's, you know, we have these things that we've built in that this is what I need to do. But what I was going to say is our so-called mind, we have the conscious, and then we have the subconscious. I just forgot how to spell. And then we have the unconscious. Now, there is a small space between the unconscious and subconscious. This is the stuff that we keep down like that spring. These two, the subconscious and conscious, switch places all the time. Like, if I say, don't think about the color of your car. Pop into your conscious, my car's blue, or my car's white, or whatever. Now I'll say, what's the front door of your house look like? So the color of your car now drops down into subconscious, and what your front door looks like pops up. You're not thinking about your car anymore until I say it again. But, so these two change positions all the time. The subconscious is all the information that you know, and when there's enough amplitude put into it, like me asking a question, you know, what's your favorite item of clothing? What's your favorite food? You know, what did you come here to heal? Now that you just hold your breath. So those pop back and forth depending on the energy that is applied, the question that's asked, or whatever that resonates that information, and it pops forward into the conscious. Now the unconscious is what we push down. We don't want to deal with the event that happened 40 years ago that I'm not looking at, or whatever. When you're asleep, this opens up more. And the unconscious information floats up easier. You have dreams, maybe nightmares. I have a whole lot less nightmares than I did, though. When Michael and I first got married, and he was so tapped into me that a lot of times he would reach over and just go, breathe. Before I even realized that it was a nightmare, or before my nightmare woke me up, he was just tapped in enough, he'd reach over and just touch me and say, breathe. And but now they've gotten less because I've been doing work around it and everything. Instead of pushing it all down and not dealing with it, then I'm starting looking at what are the issues with things and allowing it to come forward. But that's what PTSD is. You know, a lot of them have, like, I know Michael for a long time, not my Michael, but Michael C. He and his wife couldn't sleep in the same bed because he would go into full-blown PTSD during the night having nightmares, and he's liable to hit her or choke her or something. And, of course, he didn't mean to. He'd be back in the... you know, war or whatever. And so they would sleep in different beds, and now he's been doing enough work that they're back in the same bed again, you know. So it's being able to get in here and to look at it, because we're carrying it around and just saying, I don't want to go there, I don't want to look at it, isn't going to make it go away. And it's going to impact the physical, mental, and emotional of our life. And so we want to get in there. But that's what PTSD is. It's those unconscious things popping up when they're triggered, and you put enough energy in there, enough things that are on that sheet that I handed out get popped, and then it just, the whole blown thing comes forward. So four things will happen when you start doing your work. If the other members of your family, whether it's a spouse or whoever, doesn't, one of four things will happen. First thing is, they will be like, wow, I really like what you're doing, what you've got, I like the changes I'm seeing, and I want some. And that's, of course, the ideal. Second thing is, you know, it looks really good on you. I support you doing it. I don't want it. which sounds like kind of who you are, you know. And that's up to you individually, you know, and I know a lot of couples that they're okay with that. You know, he's okay with her going forward and learning and doing and, you know, being, you know, doing the spiritual work or whatever, and she's okay that he doesn't do it. And so they're at that point, and it's a mutual agreement, it's fine. You know, and so a lot of times they'll say, it looks good on you, I support you keeping on doing it, but I don't want it. Third thing is, they'll be so pissed because now you're not controllable. Because when you start uncovering these things and start doing your work, then the hold that the world has on you lessens and lessens, and you're not controllable. And they don't like that, so they'll crank the heat up to get you back the way you were, where you were controllable.
That's what
happens. That often happens even in with employers or something, you know. And so it can happen in any relationship. And the fourth thing is, there's no reason to come out of here. And that's usually the other person not doing their work that says, I'm out of here, and leave. There could be, I actually talked about this on the radio show with Camille, I think it was yesterday. And she's kind of in that situation. And she feels like, you know, she's doing the work and she wants to do what she can to resolve their situation and their issues and stay together. But he's not willing to meet her halfway or do his part in it, and it's causing issues, they're bringing up issues between them. And I said, you know, you have to determine yourself. Nobody can say, well, you need to get out of that relationship. But if you leave a relationship out of your fear or your hostility, what was this? Have you ever done something you regret?
You'll do it all over again.
So you will do it all over again. You need to get back to a totally connected space. You know, I've seen couples where they're, you know, friends, and they're like, you know, I love you, and I bless you, and I wish this would work out between us, but it's not going to. I'm going this way, and you're going that way, and they part friends, and everything's okay.
That's what we did.
And that is the way, if you choose to dissolve it and then continue to do your work around it, or you'll bring it back in again, because it'll be a lesson you haven't got yet, so you get to bring it in again and learn it again. But if you just say, you know, you're not doing your part, then you're in this side, and then you split, and you'll do something you regret, and it won't be a happy ending. Okay? There's also a thing called, and I'm throwing all these things out because I'm getting ready to do the worksheet, and so I want some things stirring.
Wake up sheet,
yes, thank you very much. So, leaving and withdrawing, being mine, was, I call it pain by choice. Because if someone else leaves, and it brings up hurt, and, oh, they left me, and I can't control this, and I can't do it because they're the ones that left. But if I leave, then I'm in control of how much it hurts. It's the same thing with a twist of people cutting. I've worked with a lot of people who cut. And there's several reasons why they do. A lot of times they cut because they are in so much pain internally, and they don't know what to do to relieve that. And it's like they're lost to it, but they can control how much this hurts when they cut. They can't control how much it hurts in here, but they can control how much this hurts. Then the second thing that happens is your body sends out endorphins and things to, you know, start clotting the blood and anesthetize it and all that. And you can actually, after a time, get high on that feeling. It's a hard way of doing that, but it happens. And then a lot of times they're so lost in pain and what's going on for them that they don't feel. It's like just going through life and nobody can touch them. I mean, it's, and I don't mean physically. It's like, you know, nothing penetrates that shell that they put up. It's like they're zombies going through life. They have no feelings, no laughter, no joy, no sadness, no anything. They're just like, you know, automatons just doing what they have to do. And when they cut, they know they're still alive because it hurts. It's pain by choice. And so that is a hard way of doing it, but I think leaving, for me, was just as hard. It was, I control the hurt. I control how much it hurts. And so being willing to let that go, instead of punishing myself, and then there's a way of punishing, is to be willing to face it and move through it. Does that make sense? So when you say you don't punish, think of all the ways that you do punish yourself. You know, because we all do. And what you're using to control what you're feeling, if you don't get the handle on it and do your work around it, will become the thing that controls you.
Say that again.
Yeah, it took me a while even when I wrote it down to get it. Okay, so the thing that you use to control the pain, so in my case, leaving, and a person who cuts, they're using that to control something in their life. If you don't do your work around it, and you don't resolve it, and you don't forgive it, then it will become the thing that controls you. So my leaving would control me. It would control my decisions of where I am and what I do, and people that cut, it's like they can't handle anything else, so they have to go cut again, and then they cut again. And it becomes controlling over them instead of them controlling it. So it's another reason to dig down in and take care of that.
Like any addiction.
Yes, it is. It's an addiction. Absolutely. And learned helplessness. And you can, you know, one that has a fence around, or an invisible fence around the yard, and they know if they go so far they get zapped, you know. And then you can disconnect the fence after a while, and they still won't go there because they learned they're trapped. And so even though there is a way out, they don't step through that to get out. And so we are trapped in some of our garbage, and we have an open door that we can get out. And it's up to each one of us whether we want to do that or not. We can stay stuck in it and say, there's nothing else I can do, I'm just here, or we can step through it. So the next tool that we're going to do is the forgiveness worksheet.